So one of the wonderful things about the ADS-CFT duality is the fact that we can maybe make predictions for QCD, which are non-perturbative. And this is really quite exciting. And in fact, much of the Hadron community is very excited about this prospect. And so what we're talking about is Malvasina's ADS-CFT, which tells us that this 10-dimensional space is actually dual to supersymmetric QCD n equals 4, a perfectly conformal theory. And it's because they both share the SO42 symmetries of conformal symmetry, which allows one to do this. So, but of course, that's not QCD. QCD is not conformal. But on the other hand, there are a lot of aspects of QCD which are close to conformal. In many senses, it's nearly conformal. One of the first observations about this is, I think it's from Parisi, who observed that if you take perturbative QCD formulas and you put beta goes to zero and you put MQ goes to zero, you will get, in fact, the predictions of conformal QCD. That's obvious. It's a fixed alpha strong formula and so on. But it's actually very useful because you can turn this around and you can make predictions in QCD of the following type. You take an observable, the annihilation cross-section, for example, and you expand it in terms of what's called conformal coefficients, which are determined from the conformal theory. They're independent of beta. And then you have expansion in alpha strong to power n, and then you put all the physics of non-zero beta into alpha strong where it belongs. And this is called the conformal template, and allows you to make predictions based on the underlying conformal symmetry of the theory, and at the same time, fix the scale at every order in perturbation theory. It's a beautiful method. And it's been used many, many times in different contexts. Operator product expansions, one of the most beautiful applications is distribution amplitudes, in which you can actually, these are then functions of x, like front x, and they're determined then completely by conformal symmetry. Brown and Kachemsky are experts on this. Another application of this is what's called commensurate scale relations. You start with a relation which is true in conformal theory, and then you simply improve it by putting the non-zero beta function in, and you relate every observable to every other observable. And these become some of the most sensitive scheme-independent scale invariant tests of QCD. The most famous one is what's called the generalized Kruther relation. Kruther invented this amazing thing in conformal symmetry that you can relate Re plus E minus to the Bjorkane sum rule for the spin-dependent structure function G1. And by using this procedure, you actually can relate the Bjorkane sum rule at one scale to Re plus E minus at a corresponding scale. And so these are very, very important, interesting tests of QCD, which avoid all the problems of scheme dependence and scale dependence. Now, why do I think that QCD maybe is closer to conformal theory than you might expect? This has to do with this question about whether the running coupling has an infrared fixed point, whether it's flat at low scales. And actually, there's a lot of evidence that's recently accumulating that this is possibly true. Dyson-Schwinger analysis, Alcofer and company, there's work from lattice gauge theory, in fact, that comes up with these things. There's the whole subject of effective charges. You can define the running coupling through an observable. And for example, Re plus E minus defines alpha R, or also the tau decay into hadrons defines what's called alpha tau. And in each case, you find, in fact, this phenomenon from experiment. Now, each scheme or definition can have a different value up here, but the most important thing is that there's not very much variation in the running coupling from here to here. We can actually understand it analytically. So this gives us actually a reason to think that, in fact, we should use ADS-CFT to describe, in fact, the initial approximation, the conformal approximation to QCD, and then systematically correct for it. So how do we use ADS-C to derive conformal properties of QCD? Well, actually, Polchinski and Strasser were the innovators of this. And the typical thing what you do is you look in the fifth dimension. Here, Z is R squared over R. It's 1 over the thing. But here I plotted a typical wave function solution to the fifth dimension equation. It might be a Dirac equation, scalar equation, Rorita-Schwinger, and so on. And what you find is you have wave functions that you can make them vanish. It depends on your assumption of what you do at the scale R0, which is lambda QCD times R squared. And then it tails off. The solutions tail off like R to the minus delta, where delta is in the dimension of the leading interpolating operator, which interpolates, say, for a proton as it approaches the boundary at r equals infinity. And so these are known, of course, and you can actually, if you put in here lambda r squared equals ll plus d, you get in fact exactly this asymptotic behavior. In fact, this is justified in fact by Gubser's and all's quantum fluctuations and how you introduce orbiting momentum into this system. So actually you get the entire spectrum of hadrons this way. That the eigenvalue appears here in this five-dimensional equation, fifth-dimensional equation. But what's most important about it is we actually can read off from this behavior the actual prediction from conformal theory of lots of physics. For example, the light front wave functions automatically match onto these things as you go from the five dimensions down to four dimensions. And you find that the wave functions have to have this form of 1 over k perp squared to a power n minus 1. And then there's an orbital factor, k perp over k perp squared to the power l. And this is actually the general characteristic of a hadron's wave function in terms of n is the number of constituents and l is the orbital dependence of each of them. And so we actually learn this. Now actually this is not a surprise, because if you go back to distribution amplitudes and the operator product expansion, this exactly is what the solution has to be in order to get the operator product expansion to come out right. That's another reason why conformal symmetry is such a good guide. Now, if you know these wave functions, you can compute virtually anything, because those are the basic wave functions of hadrons. And in fact, for short distance processes, you just need this tail. And so then you get form factors go like 1 over q squared to the n minus 1. And you get hadron-hadron scattering goes like 1 over s to the total number of constituent fields minus 2 times a function of center mass angle. You also get this feature that the Reggie trajectories go to negative integers. So this original idea was first worked out by Polchinski and Strasser for blue ball scattering, and extended to Terramon and I, and we worked out this light front wave function. I should say also it's consistent with the work of G et al. On perturbative QCD, which gives the same type of scaling behavior. So many of these results were known, like dimensional counting from perturbative QCD, Lepage and myself, Ferrar and myself, Matejev et al. But now we have actually a non-perturbative derivation of these things, starting simply from the behavior of the theory in the fifth dimension. Okay, so what I have more in my transparencies is simply a lot of data which shows, in fact, these scaling laws, I just want to say, work remarkably well. Most, if you start with Compton scattering, 1 over s to the 6 works perfectly. Photo production with pions or cans, 1 over s to the 7th works perfectly. KP scattering, 1 over s to the 8th. Gamma D to NP has been recently measured at Jefferson Lab, and it looks like 1 over s to the 11th times a function of angle over a huge range of kinematics. So the conformal symmetry actually works in every case, in fact. There's no real exceptions. Minor little things, but this is really, in fact, a tremendous guide to the basic physics of QCD at short distances in exclusive reactions.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Kuti. He's enthusiastic. I don't understand lots of things, but one okay, particularly. Sir. What does it mean that alpha s has an infrared fixed point, and why is the lattice supporting it?
Yes, there's a paper by Fourier et al. On the web this month, where they claim, in fact, that they actually have a.
But what is this. I'm
understand. Not a lattice expert.
I just don't get it. I
can tell you more about the
lattice. Just Schringer. A cutoff. I mean, it has nothing to do.
No, but people
it's
people
a
do
physics
trace.
Question. What people, is an infrared alpha s fixed point, and how do I understand it, and in what context?
Well, of course, it could be a consequence of just simply the as you're talking, so on, that when you pull the strings and so on, they break. And so you can never get the running coupling to go.
No, but suppose I am in the pure glue, then
this is supposed
it?
To be the real world. Yeah. This is the real world. So it could be the consequence of in fact the string breaking. It's not. But you know, this idea that the running coupling causes confinement has never been proved. There's many arguments. There's no reason why that's in the vector potential. This is not UV. This is going down to low scales. I'm sorry. This goes all the way down to small scales.
Isn't?
No. That's not my. I can't prove that from. I don't think anybody's proved that from five dimensional. I don't want to make that confusion. What is There is evidence, though, from Dyson-Schwinger equations, for example, all sorts of evidence, phenomenological evidence. For example, I can show you the data for alpha tau, for example. Yeah. However, what it says is that you can understand, in fact, a lot of reasons why conformal symmetry works so well in so many phenomenological applications, simply by the fact that you're really never very far from the conformal symmetry. It's not, if you had, of course, this drastic 1 over q squared behavior, you would never be able to account for any of this phenomena. I think Eddie had a
Stan.
Question.
Edward?
Sure, yeah.
It may be about the same question. Mm-hmm. In order to really use AGS CFT, we need strong coupling. So where is the strong coupling in some sense?
Yeah, so I just need this. This value is about 0.9, for example, if you extract it from alpha tau. In fact, this is one of the things that's bothered perturbative QCD people, is that when you do perturbative QCD applications of anything as simple as the pion form factor, proton form factor, the typical Q squared in the rungs is, it's Q squared over 9, for example, is very small. So in fact, you're typically actually in this region where in fact you'd love to have it to be flat. But then it opens up the question, how can you trust perturbative QCD if the coupling's so large? That's the power of ADF-CFT. It tells you, in fact, what the consequences of conformal symmetry is right from the beginning.
Stan, I'd like to understand better what the limits are on how this works. What would you say about BB bar resonances, where if you just draw a potential for it, there's certainly a approximately 1 over R piece, which is the conformal piece.
That's the 1
but
over R.
But there's more.
Yeah. That's 1 over R. I don't think there's any evidence for a linear potential in those things. In the BB
bar
system.
I don't think that BB bar resonances fit the hydrogen atom that well.
No, but there's no evidence for a 1 over Q squared piece. I think that's true. Nobody's ever used that. And certainly there's no evidence it's in the vector channel where this would, if you had the 1 over q squared behavior, it's purely the vector channel. And people who do models never put it in the vector channel. They usually put it in the scalar channel. Arkady had a question.
We can have more of a free-for-all later, and I think we should encourage that. But we do have one more presentation.
Put this on just to show the gamma D to MP data. This prediction of conformal symmetry, what about
SC11? I made a prediction at the beginning of this conference, Stan, first
of all, by the way. But I still think we've set a record. Thank you, Stan.
Very good.
So, thank you. In fact, I have to transpose this. I've been talking about
that.
Is it working?
Yes, good.
Yeah. So I would like to describe two different regimes. So I would like to describe some work which was done with Rob Peshansky on using Woodson loops to consider scattering, and mostly to raise some questions which are still open and would be interesting to investigate further. So first, if we look at scattering in an equal to phosphor and Mills theory, and if we look at a system of two heavy QQ bar pairs, which are two external quarks moving at fast velocities, which are really decoupled from the theory. So what one has to calculate is two Wilson loops. So then one has minimal surfaces, and these minimal surfaces interact by exchange of supergravity fields, and the dominant contribution comes from the graviton, which is 2. So intercept is 2. Now the question is what are the 1 over square root of lambda corrections? So of course, at recoupling, we have the BFK result, and somehow it has to interpolate to 2. We had George Wojcicki talk that this coefficient should be 2 here. And it will be very interesting to also recover the same result from a string amplitude in exactly in this context, just to see. And if one can do it, in fact, one can then pose some questions of principle, namely the question of integrability. One knows that the BFK intercept really is an eigenvalue of an SL to C XXX integrable spin chain. So what happens with integrability when one goes to strong coupling? And here one may speculate that, in fact, the role is played by well-sheet integrability for a cylinder. Because if one would calculate a cylinder amplitude in an integrable theory, then one has to solve thermodynamical beta ansatz equations, which will be dependent on the energy in this case. So hopefully, it could answer the question if the integrability goes on to strong coupling or not. Then the next open question, which will be very interesting to address, is saturation. Roughly, this stuff is a strong coupling analog of BFKL. Now, we have that there's a kind of recombination term due to gluon recombination. So what is the analog in ADS-CFT? This equation is completely conformal, so this is really a big open question which one does not even know how to formulate an ADS-CFT clearly. So it's one really very interesting thing to study and to try to pinpoint what physics comes in. Now I would like to move to confining regime. So here we used black hole background. And if we look at regional exchange, so an exchange of two mesons with an exchange of quark, then the whole complicated gluon exchanges are substituted by some kind of minimal surface. And one is led to some complex saddle point, which gives a linear trajectory like alpha prime t, a shift of the intercept, and the remaining intercept is due to fluctuations, and the remaining intercept is zero due to spin. Now, it turns out that branch cuts of this formula get automatically additional exchanges of a particle with a slope alpha prime over 4. So something like additional Pomeroy exchange on top of the regional exchange. So then we went to investigate how to, in fact, earlier, isolate this type of exchange by itself. In terms of if one just looks at QQ bar plus a cutoff put in by hand, looks at the minimal surface, and then again goes to branch cuts, one recovers a slope alpha prime over 4, which is it's a constant and with the soft Pomeroy slope, in a way, and an intercept due to fluctuations like n perpendicular over 96. So if I plug in 7, it will be 1.07 or something like that. And here, in fact, it's quite amusing because phenomenologically one knows that Pomeroy in a way couples to single quarks, that those quark counting rules. So this picture seems to, in a way, support it in some kind of limits. But there are lots of questions. In fact, there are much more questions here than one can answer. Namely, in fact, all this contribution came really from a branch cut. So it was really some kind of saddle point with surface with continued analytically outside of the physical space. So really, one cannot say that this is a Pomeroy or like something like that. So it would be good to have a rich interpretation of the branch cut contribution. Then one could ask what changes for non-critical strings, because then the calculation of the fluctuations assumed that the string is critical. So one can drop away the conformal factor. But more interesting thing is that one could ask what happens to the soft hard transition. Mm-hmm. Here we are in the regime of large impact parameter, so very small t. So we have a redshift which feels really the flat geometry close the horizon. When we would decrease the impact parameter, one would really be in the regime of conformal physics, so roughly what was before, what was on the previous transparency. But it would be really interesting to see, to be able to address some of these questions quite, more quantitatively. I mean. And also, the last open question, again, is saturation, because as we heard, in fact, if one would like to study impact parameter dependence, then the conformal saturation really always gives power law phase in impact parameter. But experimentally, one has some exponential terms, tails which are due to confinement. So it's really, it will be again interesting to ask again the question of saturation, but now in the context where confinement plays a role.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you. So I just wanted to understand, you got this change in the behavior, change in the intercept by going from conformal theory to something that you call confining, black hole background. But you still got the power growth of the cross section, nevertheless.
Yes.
I mean, at what range of energies, let me ask you this way, at what range of energies you think your second calculation works?
I would say that I'm really very happy that something which looks qualitatively similar to the real world comes out. I mean, this is too, I mean, this is too model dependent. I mean, there are too many issues open here that I cannot really give any numbers. But there was a paper by Stephen Giddings who considered in the confining theory the regime where one enters the first outbound violation. And there, this was due to formation of black holes in the curve geometry. So of course, this type of behavior is completely cannot be captured using this minimal surface point of view. So, but I cannot give any numbers, of course. It's, I mean, here I was mostly happy with the fact that qualitative behaviors of scattering physics appear coming from those minimal surfaces and from this type of mathematical structures, which was quite surprising, I mean, from the time.
Isn't true that in planar limit you will never be unitary constraints.
I don't know. I have opposite answer to this question.
Yes.
I would like just to add a comment to what you said, that you said that what is seen in data is this exponential fall down of the T distribution, which has something to do with confinement. I think that what is really seen is really that we see something similar to the exponential. Of course, we cannot be completely sure that this is exponential because the range over which we fit is a little too small. It is definitely consistent with exponential. It is also consistent with other forms. However, what we see is that the size of this object is very small. It is really below half a Fermi. It may be 0.3 Fermi. It is as small as this one. And this is where I think there is still no confinement on this scale. So it is, we see an exponential, but I think it's with a size which is too small to be, you know, due to confinement.
Well, anyway, so you mentioned in your talk that the size of the frog in the transverse space is smaller than the one found by Hofstadter. Well, the guy was talking about three-dimensional picture, you're talking about two-dimensional picture, and if you're talking about the mean square root radius, there is a factor of two-thirds. So if the proton size in 3D is 1 centimeter, in your case, it will be 0.6.
Well, I think one can spend many hours, but I think, you know, I discuss it with several people, and you know, these numbers, and you know, there was quite an agreement that we see something which is small. No, I think this is a longer discussion about what number we discuss and something like this. But at the end, I think several people agree that the size is too small. Let us, you know, we have to discuss it for a longer time.
It's too small. I'm not saying that you can compensate the whole size. What I'm saying is that there is a factor of two-thirds going from 3D to 2D.
Joyce?
I have a question about the whole picture of Regi trajectories and particularly glue balls. And, you know, I don't know much about strings. I am not even a theorist, but here is the question. When you look at a fixed dense string at large scales or a winding string, then we have a control parameter and we can sensibly talk about an effective string description, which I understand is not your microscopic string. And hopefully one day you can make a prediction how the terms of that effective string are emerging from the calculations. And so there is a connection. So my question about the glue ball is that Is there an equivalent easily seen control parameter where you can go from an effective string-like description to the microscopic connection? Because all what we see at low energies, slimy glue balls, if we could calculate on the lattice or elsewhere with your favorite cutoff, the spectrum at large angular momentum, you expect it to grow into some sort of a closed string which has a control parameter to develop an effective theory? How should I think about it?
Who wants to take that?
I mean, there's certainly every reason to expect that when you go to high spin and that you develop something which is effectively semi-classical string. But yes, if it's pure glue, it's a spinning closed string, and it's the
control parameter there.
Sorry, if the spin
angular momentum, suppose yeah. on the lattice.
Huh? It's basically, yeah.
Somehow, right.
The control parameter.
The idea would be to seek for an effective Lagrangian which is in 1 over j.
Yes, exactly. Because it's basically 1 over the length. Just 1 over the length.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're using the fact that the length gets big when the spin gets big.
No, but of course, you would hope that it's an object which has also some sort of a density that you can write derivatives or something. It's damn hard to imagine how you write an effective. It's possible, I guess.
Is there any problem technically in writing down strings in a rotating frame? Try to see this?
It probably would. I'm just curious. It probably would work somehow.
Okay. Do we have any more comments or questions?
I want to ask a question to the first speaker, to Kawashi. Well, actually, I already asked it, but let me, persist. So if you measure this total cross-section of the scattering of virtual photon at the proton, then one would expect that at large energies, at large W, at large S, it should grow as S to the power, which is intercept of soft Pomeron, not... Well, at very high energies, probably it's a part of Pomeron, but at the energies which you measure, it should be soft Pomeron. Is it what you see or you don't? Because you didn't present your data in a way that I would see that it's indeed, this power is intercept 0.07 or 0.08. That's the question.
Well, I think I said this already 2 or 3 times, but let me just repeat it again. The rate of rise, do you hear me? Yeah. The rate of rise which we observe is really Q square dependent. If we are at Q square is, virtuality of the photon. And if the virtuality of the photon is relatively small, we observe the usual non-perturbative Pomeron. I mean, the power of rise is 0.08.
Okay.
But only at small q square. This means q square of something like 1. If we are already at q square of 4, we have a higher power, something like 0.15, let's tell. And at q square of 20 or 30, we have 0.3 or 0.4. No, 0.3. I think the highest what we see with some errors, 0.35. No, it is not flattening. It just goes up, it grows, but then we stop to measure. Around Q square, let's tell, of 100, we do not measure anymore.
One would expect, I don't know, but one would expect that even at Q square 10 or 20 G squared, for very high energies, you should observe this power 0.8, for very high energies.
Well, for very high energies, I may expect even, zero, yes? Very high energies.
So at the energies, okay, so at the energies which you see, you don't, okay,
thank you. I actually have a comment.
I actually have a comment and a question. So a comment about rigid trajectories. So for globals, it is very clear because we can identify the classical string configuration with the right quantum numbers in the gauge theory. That is a closed string that spins in whatever geometry it is. And it is more or less computed what the trajectory has to look like. So that's well understood. And I have a question for Joe. I wanted to see to what extent you can explain a little bit more what are the approximations that go into the string theory that you compute. For example, the vectors operators, how do I know that they are really marginal or that doesn't matter, these kind of things?
You know, it's really a graft of supergravity and string theory because as long as the momenta are small, then the vertex operator physical state conditions are just the field equations of the supergravity theory, and at some level that's really all that's being used. All of the calculations were actually in supergravity, although I used string theory to justify the framework. Presumably there is some string sigma calculation that you can use to go further in tough parameter, but we haven't set that up yet because it would require, you know, really doing the string theory in the Ramon background.
Unless
a comment about Reggie.
I would suggest we try and keep things short and then have further discussion lubricated with some wine.
I just
which
want to make
was waiting for us.
Somebody could bring some in.
No, I was just going to say that there's valuable data from LEP on gamma star goes to inclusive. So here you have the BFTL Pomeran being probed as a function of Q1 squared and Q2 squared over a significant range of Q1 squared and Q2 squared. This, I think, is perfect data for this type of analysis. And also I want to urge people to look at the non-singlet regions because they're very appropriate to what's measured at, in the past. I mean, there's a lot of data on the regi behavior function of T for non-singlet cases. So that even should be easier than the gluon exchange case. It's just quark exchange.
That's one final question. Mm.
Yeah, I want to raise a question about whether we can understand by using string theory what happened to the Frossow bound as the mass gap goes to zero. So in QCD, if you take m pi goes to zero, the Frossow bound disappears. And we now know there are examples with gravity duals of theories that has confinement but no mass gap. So what would happen to the Frossow bound in these theories? And maybe that's a good thing to understand.
Steve Gitting showed that in the usual massive case, black hole formation seemingly exactly saturated the Frossard bound. But I don't know; it's hard to see how that would extend to cases like what Steve talked about, where there's no mass gap. I don't see why. It's not clear how these two things fit together.
There may be maybe there's some n counting. If you only have one light particle, as opposed to n gluons, it's subleading. There's definitely some subtlety there, but for discussion, Steve will make a presentation tomorrow, so we can come back to this.
So one final thing before we break is to thank all the speakers of this afternoon session and including our discussion.